sound check.
There's not much work involved with all that. That's what I'm saying. Just for that little bit of work, but somebody's got to do it.
Yeah.
He usually stays here on a Sunday and does it.
Just talk a little bit more. What did you have for breakfast today?
I had a peanut butter and banana and honey sandwich.
Okay. All right.
It's my staple.
Just like Elvis likes.
Is it?
Well, peanut butter and banana. I don't know about that.
It was fried. Was it?
Probably was.
Fried, I think.
Yeah. Probably put some bacon in there, too.
Sure,
but I know peanut butter and mashed banana is what he
threw
up on. So.
Sounds good, too.
Yeah.
I'd want to fry one, but yeah, it's bad enough.
We're getting old.
Mm-hmm. I can just breathe and take on weight.
Yeah. As you can see, me, too. Okay, there's a consent form here to sign, but you can do it at the end if you want. Basically, it just says that they have the right to share this interview. You know, this is for the Louisville Underground Music Archive that's in the U of L Library.
Right.
And after, you know, I think we'll sign it after we talk, just so, because you can put restrictions on.
Okay.
You know, like if you feel like, you know, you didn't want Sean Garrison to hear what you said about it, you know, you could say, you know, sections about Sean Garrison cannot be released until after he dies. But at any rate,
it's a bit much.
But you do have, you know, you do have that right, because it is your thing. Okay, so. Just to get this off officially started, this is Chip Nold. I'm interviewing Mark Abramovich, guitarist in bands such as Malignant Growth, Fading Out, King Horse, Arch, and The Decline Effect. I'm missing one. Am I missing one?
No, yeah. What? MFG, Fading Out, Arch, Decline Effect. I guess that's it.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
All right.
King Horse, did we say that?
Yeah. Okay. All right. We're talking at Fire Studio. Is that the name of it?
Right.
Fire Studio, where he works, on September 30th, 2016. So, born. Wait, hold on. Okay. When and where were you born?
When and where?
Were you born in Louisville?
Yeah.
Okay. And when were you born?
Where?
When?
Year?
What, yeah.
Oh, 1961.
Okay. All right. You're from Louisville?
Right.
Okay. Where did you go to high school?
Butler High School.
Okay. Right.
Vaguely.
Okay. Where in Louisville did you live when you were young?
Initially, grew up in the West End, so right across the street from Fountain Ferry for a few years. Moved into Portland a few years, and then we moved right on the outskirts of Shively I was at the end of elementary school, so we moved out there, and then, you know, mother still lives there.
So. Okay, and so that's where you were living when you got involved in the music scene?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. What did your parents do for a living?
Mom was a waitress. My aunt owned a restaurant, like a, you know, little Greasy Spoon down the West End. She worked there for, 25 years or so. And then the place wound up folding. Then she got a job at Humana, and then wound up retiring from there.
Okay. Well, that was May's Wiz, right?
Right.
I remember that. Yeah. Okay. And so May was your aunt.
Right.
Okay. All right. So how did you get introduced or interested in music? What do you remember?
Always grew up, you know, with an older brother that always seemed like he was interested in music, and then I don't know, I just became fascinated with you know, just certain music. I mean, I don't, for some reason, I remember listening to the Beatles. But, you know, it was, I think what happened is, you know, my aunt had a jukebox.
Okay.
In the restaurant, and we'd always, you know, they would play that, and she would get all the, when they restocked the jukebox, she would get all the, you know, the singles. And then I would listen to them over there, or, you know, or my brother would get some of them. I remember listening to the beginning of the hell that Beatles song, was She Said So? You know, what?
She said the one. I know what it's like to be.
No,
that,
no. It's like.
I feel fine, right?
Yeah.
She says so? Yeah, okay.
Right, but just like the beginning, I think there's a beginning note in that. Just
right,
kind of.
And feedback.
Right.
And yeah.
And just, you know, just certain things always grab me, you know, because she would always have all the weird, like, novelty records, you know. So it's just always been kind of a part of my life, but not really, not necessarily the musical aspect, you know. Not, and then brother finally, he went off to service, wound up learning how to play guitar.
Okay.
And then that, then he gave me his, I think, I don't know about his first, but it's my first acoustic guitar, which I still own to this day.
How old were you then?
I want to say I was 16.
Okay. All right. And you hadn't really played before then?
No. Well, other than, you know, just trying to play his upside down. You know, the burden of being left-handed.
Right, right. So, and your brother Chris, how much older is he than you?
4 years.
Okay. All right. So he gave you this guitar, and then what did you start doing with it?
You know, just trying to figure things out. I mean, it was, he played a little bit. But I've never been good enough to play, like, other people's music. I can play bits and pieces, but I get frustrated or whatever, move on. And, you know, so it's always been, you know, a little bit of here and there. And then I got to the point where I wanted to play lead or just be able to do, you know, other things. And that seemed like it was pretty fun. So, you know, started playing to records and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, was Malignant Growth your first band then?
Right, yeah.
Okay. So, tell me how that came together.
Well, it was always, you know, me and Kenny Ogle, and he was kind of like the, I don't know about the brainchild, but he was the, he always pursued it, you know what I mean? He was the one that was like, let's do this, let's do, you know, and, so we always wound up, me trying to play, you know, guitar, and him trying to sing into, a, you know, like a little cassette recorder.
Right.
So that's how we kind of initially tried to start, you know, writing music and songs. And yeah, I think that was it.
So when would that have been?
That would have to be, like, either early, like, you know, either early 79, maybe.
Okay. All right, so you'd already gotten involved in the punk scene by then, right?
I guess maybe so. I mean, to some degree, but...
I mean, because we met in 78, maybe it was more early 79, at any rate, okay. I'm trying to remember the years, but I think when... all the Louisville bands like No Fun and the Babylon Dance Band started out was 78. And so you all came to the thing on Main Street in 78, right?
No, I think Kenny did.
Kenny did. Oh, you weren't with him?
No. Okay. Kenny had saw, and I don't know if it was, it was like a first floor thing. And they, like, you know, I vaguely remember him trying to, something about climbing in and out of windows or whatever.
Okay, so that was the show at it was the old Galt House right there at 2nd and Main. And Kenny came to that. So what was the first show you remember coming to?
Oh, geez. I mean, it had to be, you know, a Babylon Dance Band show, I would think. But, you know, where it was at, you know, where that was at Woody's Tavern.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Or, you know, there was so many, and I don't remember the order of them, but I want to say it was something even not so, something non-bar oriented, maybe even better.
Or something.
Yeah, I want maybe the Red Barn, one of the New Wave festivals. Okay. Or something.
So, well, let's go back a little bit. Why, I mean, you know, punk rock was not the popular thing. It's never been the most popular thing, but it really wasn't the popular thing then. Why were you attracted to it? Why was it that it was, you know, the kind of music that interested you?
Well, I think mainly, you know, like a lot of the mainstream music, whether it was, you know, disco at the time or whether it was, I don't think corporate rock had really blossomed by then, but everything, it was more, I want to say down to earth, more along, you know, my thought process, I guess. But mm-hmm. being able to just, you know, it was something I could relate to.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like grassroots, you know, back alley, whatever. But that always, you know, what, and it was, you know, the music itself was aggressive and tend to be, you know, more upbeat. And to this day, I still listen to upbeat music. But
yeah,
I mean, I think it's, you know, I think that and, you know, what they were, you know, what the bands were saying, what little I could understand, you know, because then that was a lot of the English bands.
Right. Okay. All right. So we kind of talked a little bit, but one of the questions that interests me is, you know, in what way did the music seem different from what you'd experienced before?
Well, I mean, a lot of it has, I get the music itself or the scene part of it.
Well, that was my next question. Oh. Which, however you want to take it.
Well, let's see. I kind of lost my train of thought there.
How was the music or the scene different from what you'd experienced before? How was it a new thing for you?
Well, I think because there wasn't a music scene, so to speak, in anything I was part of. You know, there was all these people that had a, it wasn't like a gang or, you know, nothing like that, but it was just the people that had like-minded visions or, you know, they were just a little off-center.
Uh-huh.
And really didn't care, you know, if what you brought to the table. You know, as long as you were, you know, I won't say, you know, least respectful to everybody, you know,
yeah.
Everybody got along with one another, and there was just, you know, it was always nice people involved with it. You know, I mean, the music and the people itself don't necessarily, you know, you want to think of the aggression and all that, but those people are not like that, say, mm-hmm. you know, on a one-on-one basis.
Okay. All right. So how did you hear new music back in those days?
Usually it had a lot to do with either the friends or the, you know, the parties or whatever, you know, the music that you would go to or the scene or the shows and the music that was played. You know, while you're waiting for bands or whatever, or the friends that had the money and that would buy records,
right.
And such. And there, you know, it was always something new.
Okay. Does anything stick out for you in terms of, like, you know, man, I remember I heard that record and that just really changed my idea of what music would be?
I don't know. I mean, there was always milestones in what you would listen to. You know, like we would struggle or we always searching for something different, something new. I mean, so when you heard, you know, like the first time you heard the Sex Pistols, it was just, you know, like damn, you know. And then you get beyond that. You hear like the Exploited, which is a total, I mean, it's like another notch up, you know. And so it's, it was always the new music that's driving you to look for more new music. I mean, you know, I remember hearing, like being up in Lexington, probably one of your all shows, and hearing The Day the World Turned Dayglow.
Okay.
Yeah, right. And you just think like, well, what? You know, like that's great.
That's an excellent choice. I can remember hearing that for the first time too. Yeah, yeah. It was just like,
yes. I mean, even being and it necessarily wasn't so much guitar driven or whatever, but it was just the whole package. You know, it just seemed to, it's just to make it.
Okay. Well, so you were saying that Chris, you know, so you, I guess you were playing with Kenny before you were playing with Chris. Was Chris still?
I think he was still. Yeah, I think he was still in the service, but he wasn't. He's kind of a. He had a different mindset as far as music and such, and you know, he was familiar with some new wave stuff, so to speak, but he was still more into. You know, trying to figure out some 70s rock and stuff, you know, whether it was Sabbath or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that was more along his lines.
So how did he get roped in then when he came back?
Well, you know, I think because, you know, we started thinking about, you know, playing music. And I picked up the guitar and I was playing. I don't know if I was better, but I seemed a little more adept at it than he was. So he thought it might have been a logical choice for, you know, him to start playing bass because there couldn't be two guitar players in the family,
right?
For whatever reason.
Okay. Well, so what was it like? I mean, I was thinking about that. I mean, what was it like playing with your brother? I mean, there are a lot of brothers in the early Louisville punk bands, right? And
right.
O'Bannon's, yeah. And the Durigs and all.
It was, you know, it was rough at times. You know, I mean, because we're, you know, he's pretty headstrong, pretty much a know-it-all. And so he, you know, and we've always had some sort of brother, you know, brotherly clash as far as, you know, just playing together. So I don't know. I just don't, you know.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's being brothers. I just. Well, so you were sort of talking about you decided to, you wanted to play music out in front of people. What do you think the motivation was there?
I don't know. I think it was probably seeing, you know, the other bands, and it's not like you never think, well, maybe you do, but you always think, well, I could do that, or, you know, you don't ever say, well, I could do better, but, you know, it always looked like fun, and there was people that were, at the time, it seemed like there was a lot of people on the same skill set or whatever, you know, that it wasn't too, it didn't seem like it was too far removed to be able to do it. And I think there was people that nurtured the thought that, you know, you could do it.
Okay. All right. Well, so, I mean, tell me about, just a little bit about your brother. Talk as much as you'd like, or however you'd like, about Kenny. He was kind of an extraordinary person in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was always, wouldn't know where to start. Yeah, because there was two different Kennys, you know. There was the Kenny that played the music. I mean, he was always a social person, but he always had a little bit darker side, you know, the stuff, mm-hmm. stuff that I got to see or deal with. Mm-hmm. You know, it was always, you know, I need money, I need to borrow some money, lend me some money for this, that, you know, like buy my records. You know, he would buy record, you know, that was the friend that would help me further my record collection.
Uh-huh.
Because he would buy records and then not long after he bought them, he'd want to sell them.
Okay.
So I would get records from him. You know, and he was just always looking for some hustle.
Uh-huh.
And he, you know, is a good person, or, you know, but like I said, he would always be into something or trying to think of how he could get something from somebody. Or
sure.
And it was always me and him together, but it was always me getting caught. So, it always left a kind of a bad taste in my mouth, you know, that I get suckered in, and then I'm the one getting in all the trouble.
Okay. Well, what do you remember about your early performances?
Actually, very little. I mean, I think our first show, my mom chose to come see. It was at the South 40.
Okay.
So the whole, you know, wasn't a very good scene for a mother or aunts or whatever. And there's the mailman.
So we were talking about early shows, and you said you thought you remembered a show at the South 40.
Right. Yeah, I think it was my mom and my aunt came out, and I guess because we probably opened, I'm sure. And she said she couldn't understand any word except for fuck. And, you know,
was she upset or amused?
I was probably more on the amused side, but, you know, I mean, it was the first and last show. I mean, she always nurtured, you know, me to be able to play, you know, put up with my guitar in the living room, you know, all the time and, you know, stuff like that. So she never complained, really, unless I plugged in and turned up.
Right.
But other than that, she's always been good as far as the music portion.
So you're saying... So did she never came to any other show?
No.
Okay.
But, I mean, you know, that one stood out. You know, it's so hard to some of the shows that we played, you know, like in the early, especially with the early days with Kenny, you know, whether it was, you know, the Tiki Lounge, where he wore a seersucker suit.
Right.
And had the issue with the guys, like, I guess because it was in a recreation hall or something.
Uh-huh.
And they were, somebody was getting on somebody else in this,
you're talking about out at the Contiki Apartments. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think he had a little altercation with some of the people out there. But, you know, it was just because they were messing with other people they shouldn't have. So he was like the, he felt it was his duty to watch over those who necessarily wouldn't take it for themselves.
Right, right.
So he was always good about that.
Okay. So, you know, did you feel like you had local influences? Were there people that you looked up to in the scene?
Oh, yeah. Of course, I always leaned toward guitar players. So, you know, Tara was always a big influence on me. And she, you know, I think you follow people as far as you can. You know, I would watch her and still couldn't figure out what she was doing, but there was certain things I could figure out. Mm-hmm. So you would take that and use that, and then there was, you know, then once you get to a certain point, it's just like you just get lost, you know.
Yeah.
And so she was big influence. And then Alex.
That's Alex Durig at right. the end tables, yeah.
So he was a big influence because he was a little heavier. Not necessarily, he wasn't as, I guess he was more along the lines of what I would like to do, but not necessarily, you know, in that style, I guess. I mean, he was heavier and mm-hmm. had the lead and stuff, whereas Tara was more, she was more chord-oriented and then had some kind of weird lead thing
right.
going, you know,
right.
her interpretation of a lead. And, but I think those, you know, and then the O'Bannon brothers,
mm-hmm.
they were kind of in a class by themselves, I guess. I mean, they, you know, the way they played was necessarily, it was a good style, but it necessarily wasn't, it showed they had ability, but it was definitely different than, you know, where I was leaning mm-hmm. toward.
Sort of that more R&B
yeah.
kind of traditional.
Kind of roots rock.
Right, yeah, yeah, exactly. Okay. We talked about this a little bit, but how did your participation in the music scene fit in or not fit in with the other parts of your life?
You know, I'm not sure playing in that, you know, playing in that scene or whatever, I don't think it was anywhere, it was like a difference, you know, it was a different side, you know, that's why, you know, I lived in the South End, but I could go to the East End to play the music, and that's where
right.
I always wanted to go, was toward the East End, because that's, you know, because that, the scene, or more so the community, or, you know, all that was a little bit more welcoming than where I was at, you know, whether it's, you know, being on the garbage truck didn't have anything to do, you know, with music and such.
But sometimes, I mean, you know, you would have to sometimes go to work, right? After you'd been playing, you know, till late at night. Am I remembering that right?
Oh yeah.
I mean, but you just did it because you were a young man and you could.
And I could, yeah.
Okay. But talk a little bit more about the South End and the East End thing, because I think that's a real important thing in the Louisville scene. You know, you just said, talking about being from the South End, coming to the East End. I mean, how did you feel, about that? I mean, you know, it's Louisville territorial lines kind of.
Right. Well, I think, you know, the whole East End was more of a, seemed like all that was easy to find. You know, if you go to the whatever house it was at, you know, at the time, whether it was
right.
in like one of the, you know, the Hepburn house or the 1069. I mean, there was always, you always knew where the people were at.
Right.
You know, I mean, not necessarily if you could go there or whatever, but you could drive by and they'd be there. You could see them, you know. South End was a little more scattered, a little more, I think it was a little less visible. I mean, you know, it's like, it wasn't easy being, you know, being in a punk band or, you know, in the South End. And I think just because there wasn't a localized place for the people to be at, you know, other than, you know, maybe the record stores. Maybe that was the place where you might occasionally see, you know, like people or
uh-huh.
where that type of music was at.
What was the record store? I'm trying to remember.
It was Phoenix.
Phoenix.
Yeah. And like, what, Dixie Highway in Greenwood.
Okay.
And, you know, and that was... And I guess then that was more the impressionable age where, you know, you would just, just trying to soak up all the music that you could. You can go in and look and see what it was, and you know, hopefully you walked away with something good.
Yeah. A lot of times you were buying a pig in the poke, right? Because you liked the way the cover looked.
And a lot of times that worked, but sometimes, you know, you would get direction from the people working there, and it was just not necessarily, you know, what you wanted.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so talk about, you know, so Millennium Growth starts, and you're playing with Kenny, and then Kenny leaves, right?
Right.
I'm trying to just talk about the transition then from Kenny to Brett, and sort of, I feel like right around then, my impression is that you all started to change some musically as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether it's by choice or, you know, it was just those, you know, the records, like you say, that, you know, the music that you're playing. So when Kenny leaves, okay, so now we're looking for, you know, looking for another singer. So we're playing music. We have no singer. We're trying different people out, you know, whether it was Tomato or Kelly Smith.
Okay.
He sang for a while, and it was pretty much, it never really went very far other than just basement enjoyment, you know, like doing the Rock and Roll Swindle or, you know, and then, so while you're doing all that, you know, then whether, you know, you discover the Ramones or those group of people over in that neighborhood, or start getting into metal, you know, like Judas Priest and all that stuff, and you start hearing other things, and it's just like, well, I mean, there is other, you know, I think it was the start of probably the speed metal and all that stuff. So you get more, you start hearing more and more, and it's like, well, yeah, I kind of like that. You know, I like playing fast and a heavier edge, so it all works pretty good. So as that kind of blooms, you know, then like all those group of people, you start running into people that knew, you know, all those people, like they knew people who sang or didn't, you know, whatever. So wind up with Brett. And Brett Ralph, he had the, he was more into the records part of it and the music and whatever. And he started getting into all the West Coast, you know, punk scene. So, you know, going through, you know, looking through Maximum Rock and Roll and all that stuff and you know, discovering Black Flag and bands like that. So I think with everything involved, I think that's how it all kind of started gravitating toward a different sound.
Okay. Well, so Brett was, what, 16?
I think so.
I mean, and you guys, what were you, in your early 20s, am I right?
Maybe. I mean, I might have been 20, 21, maybe.
Okay. And then Chris was 4 years older, so Okay. I mean, so, but that's a big gulf at that age, right? I mean, he's still in high school.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we'll just talk about that a little bit. I mean.
Well, the first time when he showed up, Irv Ross,
yeah.
I think he was a friend of Brett's, brought him over because, you know, that was who they knew. And I think Sid or Todd Fuller, the drummer, I think he knew him. And they wind up bringing him over, and we were having a band practice. So our thoughts were we needed beer, so we went and got a pony keg of beer.
Okay.
And I'm not sure we even found a microphone that day. But I guess, you know, from then on, you know, I guess he decided that it was good enough.
Well, and it's more interesting to me that you all decided that you would allow a 16-year-old into your thing. What was it about him that?
Well, I mean, because he's, you know, he's a lot bigger than a 16-year-old. He had ideas. He had, you know, songs or poetry, you know, stuff that could be easily converted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it just seemed like, especially with, you know, the small group of people that, you know, from there that it was a natural fit. You know, the music, the opinionation, the, you know, all that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So then I mean, I think of that time period, I think of you all becoming more of a hardcore band. Is that, I mean, I remember, because I can remember somewhere around that time, you all had long hair up to that point, and then you got real short haircuts, and it started being, you know, more, the music started being a little more in that vein. Do you accept that, or you're looking at me a little skeptical?
No, I think it's probably right. I mean, I don't know if that, you know, the haircuts came because of the music or just being tired of being, right, you know, being a hippie.
Yeah.
I mean, just having long hair is not much fun after a while.
Right.
But I think it's the whole, you know, the West Coast stuff, the, you know, whether it's like the Exploited, which is a little more, you know, heavier, hard edge, Metallica and all that stuff. I mean, you know, there were people that listened to metal that, you know, so, I mean, that's kind of always what I've always been, like, you know, like a big Black Sabbath fan, you know, heavy rock, but necessarily not capable of playing a lot of it. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of it has to do with my ability to play music and start branching out a little bit more. I mean, I always change styles and such after a while anyway. And it's not necessarily, you know, I think I'm inspired, but not really consciously. And I think I just tend to gravitate toward whatever, you know, whatever, however I feel for that period.
Mm-hmm. So how did songs get written in Malignant Grove?
It seems like it was, I mean, I did a lot of the initial writing, and then we all pieced it together. So there's music some of the music that's more bass oriented was actually, you know, a song written by Chris.
Right.
And then we kind of, you know, took it from there. And I think everybody had their own, you know, had their input as far as how things got put together. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, of course, Brett writing lyrics on the spot or then changing things up.
So it's sort of like you'd bring in some music or a riff or whatever, and then you'd work it out with right. everybody.
Right.
And it'd get changed. Okay. All right. So it seemed like at you know, Brett came in, what? Was that 82, I'm thinking? Do you remember?
That sounds about right.
So, and it seemed like, you know, the next few years, you know, were really, really this growth for you guys. I mean, you know, you played in other cities a lot more and got bigger crowds in Louisville. I mean, just sort of describe what that was like.
I don't know. It seemed pretty intense, you know, to be able to play, and, you know, have crowds. I mean, and then to be able to play for, you know, to open for a lot of these big name headlining, you know, bands.
Who were some of the ones that you opened for?
Let's see, there. I mean, Minor Threat, Black Flag, Circle Jerks, DOA. There's like MDC.
All right, I remember that show. Yeah.
Would have been Bad Brains if I hadn't been in jail. yeah, so I mean, you know, some of them were, you know, couple times we did, you know, open for the same bands and some, you know, but it was nice to be the go-to openers,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then just having the crowds, and I think a lot of it had to do with, you know, the union of those areas of, you know, where we were playing, you know, where we where we were practicing, that group over there, the people that Brett knew and all those, you know, his football players and rugby friends and all that stuff.
We were saying where we practiced, that was Chris's house in Highland Park, right? Or was that?
That wasn't necessarily the big draw, but I think it was the earlier days when we were over at Tomato's Basement.
Oh, okay. And where was that?
That was over off, it was right near my mom's house, so about a mile from there.
Okay.
And so a lot of those people from that area, they kind of carried over into the scene.
So would there be a lot of people coming over when you practiced? Would there be a crowd around in addition to you guys?
Not huge. I mean, because it was, you know, a lot of times it was, you know, some days it was even weekday parties, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we just had to practice and get before, you know, while his folks were at bingo or of course, if we went to Chris's, I mean, it was always like the same bunch, you know, it was at least a handful.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a dozen maybe.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. I'm just wondering if you had a perception of the crowds getting bigger or the band getting better in that time period after Brett came in.
I would think the band got better. I mean, you know, there's always different, you know, like markers, you know, as far as your progression, you know, and you can always tell by the songs that you write, you know, when it change, you know, when you start doing different things, whether it's, you know, the addition of leads or, you know, certain parts that break down that, you know, that you would struggle with, but you could actually pull off eventually. So, you know, musically, yeah, you could see yourself getting better. Crowd-wise, you know, it was always a crapshoot. But I think in the early days, the shows were so sparse that there, and it's kind of a built-in draw to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about, I remember, it seems like it's this time period, one of your big concepts was your superset.
Right.
Talk about that. Explain what that is.
I think somewhere along the line that I'd heard one of the Beatles records that they had come up with some ingenious thing, or at least that's how I perceived it. But whatever song on the record, whatever song ended, the last note of that song was the first note of the next song.
Okay.
And I thought that was kind of, you know, it's pretty ingenious, you know, where you could actually string songs together and not have a big, you know, key change, and then people go, you know, what the hell just happened?
Right.
So we devised a way, you know, because there's only so many notes you can start with. So whether it was, you know, the last note, and then starting with the first note on the next song, or if it was just how they would run together, you know, or why they would stop and start if you could pull it off without throwing everybody off. So, you know, we would just practice, and it, you know, maybe it could be 10 songs in a row, or, and it seemed it left a lasting impression on other people as well, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just the intensity of it and the fact that it didn't let up.
Right.
Okay. All right. I don't know. What's the most memorable Malignant Growth show for you?
No, that's a hard one. I don't, I mean, well.
If something doesn't stick out, that's fine. I mean.
It seems like it should. I mean, I really can't think of anything that.
That's cool. That. So then talk about, so then malignant growth became fading out. Talk to me about what the change, what you saw the changes being there.
Well, I think that was, a lot of it had to do with when Sid left the band.
Mm-hmm.
And then we picked up Sean Mulhall.
Okay.
And that kind of changed the dynamic of the sound.
How would you say?
It was less of a heavier edge, less intense. I mean, he could play fast, but not fast and hard. He had more finesse, more style. He could actually play drums, mm-hmm. whereas Sid was a little, well, Sid learned how to play, I think, that one of the nights that Lonesome Dave Bradley quit the band.
Okay.
So we said, anybody know how to play drums? And Sid showed up, you know, said, yeah, And he couldn't really play, but he attempted. So he got better, but then after, and I think that was, that may have a lot to do with, the style of music too, just him being able to play it. And we got, then when after he left, Sean playing, and then I think he had a little bit more input in some of the music, the way that some of the music was put together.
Mm-hmm.
Just may have been another phase of, my writing. Because, after a while, you say, well, you get tired of playing, playing so fast, so aggressive. I don't know if you consciously want to show that you can do more than just mm-hmm. play, bar chords and all that.
Right.
I'm sure it was just overall change in the whole dynamic, the band,
mm-hmm.
Brett's writing, his song, his lyrics and whatever,
mm-hmm.
Probably changed a bit. Different, music influences probably on my part.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way that you could characterize the difference between the two? You said, you talked about Sean's drumming having more finesse, but how would you say that what you were doing changed? So you said not as much bar chords, but what else?
I think it was just a little bit more, trying to play a little bit more intricate, but not so, not so heavy-handed on a lot of stuff. I mean, a lot of it's still good, but it's just the whole structure and the dynamic of trying to write songs a little more involved, I guess.
Okay. All right. So then, how long was that period with Sean and band?
I want to say it was probably a couple of years, maybe at the most.
Okay. And then that was where it broke up. At the end of that, was there a drummer after Sean or?
I think we had tried, we went out and tried actually a few different drummers, trying to keep it going, and we actually tried Kevin Brownstein, who wound up being the drummer for King Horse. We tried him out, and he just wasn't, he didn't do no homework, and Chris is just like, nope, no way. We tried some, maybe one or two other people, and they just weren't, you know, they had the enthusiasm but not the ability.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I mean, we're always kind of, I guess, kind of image self-conscious and, you know, so, well, you know, do you want that person in the band, you know?
Right, right. Do you want to answer for that person?
Right.
Yeah, I know that. Okay, so then, so it just, did it just sort of fall apart then without a drummer, or is that sort of...
I think so. I mean, I think everybody was pretty much tired of just, you know, going through the motions of it. You know, Chris being involved, he kind of, he's not very, not motivated a lot, you know, just kind of hanging out, waiting for something to happen. And it just kind of happened, you know, just we kind of moved on.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of moved on without him. And I guess that is the other thing, because we actually played a little bit. I'm trying to think. I think Kevin drank, but we got rid of Chris for a while. Or not for a while, but got, you know, moved on without him, so to speak. And we got Joe Grissom.
Okay.
And I think he played at least one show that I can remember. And then that wasn't the answer, you know. So I think after that, I think it we decided it was over.
Okay, so this is, do you remember around when that was?
It had to be, geez, that was 86, 87.
Okay. And so, then did you start King Horse? How much time before King Horse got started?
I think we got started in like early '88.
Okay, so tell me how that came together.
I think because there was all, you know, there was the other bands going on. Whether it was, Dale's the name of that band, Maurice,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, which had Mike McCaillou and Sean Garrison in it. I think they were looking, I guess after that band had split up for whatever reason,
mm-hmm.
that they were looking for another, looking to do something else. And so the story goes, they looked for, they tried to get Alex Durie to play.
I didn't know that.
And it may or may not have, I don't know if they actually got together with him or tried, but I think it was about the time that he had moved off to Bloomington. So, and I think Caillou approached me, I believe, to see if I wanted, you know, to play music. And at the time I guess I'd still playing. So I probably had some music to, you know, to use and get started, and so we just kind of took it from there.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any particular thought of what this band was going to be like? Any particular, I mean, mission statement's a ridiculous term to use, but you know, an idea of what you wanted King Horse to be.
You know, I don't think I wanted anything. You know, I mean, I was just wanting to play music again. You know, Sean was always the one that had the vision of how, you know, what image it would take on. And I was more of just, I guess, what we had, I guess we started and was playing, we were actually playing songs left over from Fading Out. So there were some songs that, you know, that we did, that, like one of them that Brett Ralph had written. there was some other material that we had that actually never went anywhere, but that was like the starting point of what we were using to play.
Okay. So it's a new group of people, right?
Right.
And I know, I mean, I feel like I met Sean through you or Brett, one or the other, but you know, you'd known him for a long time. He'd been around. Had you known Bukayu very well?
No.
Okay.
And I'm not even sure when I actually first met him. You know, I mean, it may have been just the fact that he played in Maurice, mm-hmm. somewhere along the line, you know, but other than that, I think he was in Solution Unknown.
Right.
So I may have known him from there also, but, and I guess, you know, well, it was the whole Filipino connection, you know, because Dave Pajo played in Maurice, and so it was kind of like that group of, you know, that end of town, I don't want to say those people, but.
Those guys.
Yeah, those
yeah.
guys.
Yeah. Well, so, but so, you know, I always think, you know, the band is, every band has its own personality from the people who are in it, right?
Right.
And I wonder how you would contrast, you know, because other, you know, you'd been in the same continuous band, even though personnel had changed. You know, what it was like being in a new situation for you all of a sudden.
I mean, it was different. It was kind of fun again. I mean, not to take anything away from, you know, the other band, but it, being able to play with a different group of people and have no history behind it, you know what I mean? You know, it's like when you play the same songs over and over and, right. and your fallback songs and whatever, you know, after a while it gets a little tiring. So to be able to just write new material with have no, you know, perceived idea of what you're going to, you know, come up with. You know, it's like a clean palette, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was fun. It was good.
Okay. And, yeah, I mean, I guess I'm just thinking, too. I mean, I don't really know Kevin, but, you know, Bukayu and Garrison are real, you know, characters.
Right.
So how quickly did, I mean, King Horse got so big, how quickly did that happen?
It seemed like it was pretty quick. I mean, we did, I know we put out a demo in October of 88. And then I can't even remember when our first show was with Fugazi.
Okay.
And that was, I think, over at the Sports Drome over in Indiana. You know, and it just all snowballed from there. You know, it was doing all the right shows at the right time. And it was surprising to me, you know. I mean, it was so much different than playing in, you know, in Malignant Growth or Fading Out, because there was people in attendance, and, you know, and it was still a younger crowd. You know, I mean, it might have been the same age as the Malignant Growth crowd, right. but now I'm a little older right. and they're younger.
Right.
So it was fun, you know.
Well, and you would get a couple thousand people, right?
I don't know about a couple thousand, but, you know, it was at least, you know, a little over 1,000.
Whereas an early Louisville punk show would be 100 or
yeah,
if maybe
had,
less.
Yeah, yeah, if you had 100 people, you were shitting and flying.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I can't imagine what that's like. I imagine that must have been really, really an exciting thing to really feel like you've got this big audience that you're playing for.
Yeah, I mean, I still didn't understand where they all came from.
Right.
But I think, you know, a lot of it had to do with Bukayu working at Ear Ecstasy.
Mm-hmm.
So he's, you know, he was a socialite, you know.
Right.
Rat, I don't know. Sean, I don't know where he actually fit in.
Mm-hmm.
But he always had his group of people.
Right.
So it was, I think it was just being in the right band at the right time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And were you still working on the truck at this time, or had you moved on?
No, I was still on the truck. I think we worked on the truck and and playing King Horse until we actually went out on tour. And then I quit that job.
Mm-hmm.
Or left it open to where I could come back. But
yeah. So you went out on tour when?
It would have to be early 90s. I mean, I don't...
Had you put out your album by then, or...?
Yeah, so we were actually late, because I think the album came out in October of 90. And I think we probably went out, it's probably mid-90, somewhere in 91, probably... It had to be in the summer months, but, we were probably 7-8 months overdue as far as getting out on the road.
Mm-hmm. And how long was the tour?
It was just a couple months, but, because our booking agent was a little localized.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were still doing show, we were... supposedly a national act, but still doing shows and in whatever places we could get a show at, while we're out on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of, with a big itinerary, there was a lot of shows that fell through while you're out on the road. So anywhere within 6 hours of home, we'd try and come back home if we could, even if it was for, a couple of days and go back out. So it was being on the road, but not too far from home, seems like.
Okay. All right. Well, then, I don't know if there's anything to say about recording the album. I feel like I've seen stories about that over the years, but I can't really remember what they were.
I mean, just other than, we did wasn't really any pre-production work other than, you go up in New York and they rent out a rehearsal studio.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like for all these bands that really have a stage show, because you're playing, you're right, you got a big wall of mirrors so you can see how you look like while you're playing. We got Glenn Danzig over listening, but he's more interested in playing tickle games with his girlfriend and talking about he's going to change this and change that, and we're just about ready to just go off the deep end. My head's throbbing, I've got a headache, and just the whole thought of all this, is about ready to happen. Go in the studio, and we wind up having it winds up being a big headache. He wants to change. We don't understand why.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you practice something for months on end, and then all of a sudden, the last minute when you're actually going to record, why would you change things? And from there to dealing with the head of the label telling us that this is what we need to do, and it's all for the better. And in reality, a lot of it was for the better, a little more palatable. It was different. It wasn't what, everybody in Louisville had heard or whatever. But it helped. It just, the way it all went about, it was pretty screwed up.
Mm-hmm. But you felt like it was a good representation of the band.
Yeah.
We always wonder, if we'd done this or that, but...
Right. I mean, you hear about people like, oh, they stuck to their guns and their integrity's intact and this, that, and the other. And it's just like, well, how many chances do, especially back in the day, do people, little local Kentucky bands get a chance to record, and deal with all the stuff, from... whether it's with Danzig, even the engineer was he was the engineer for the Beastie Boys'
okay.
first record. So, I mean, we had good company,
yeah.
And And you'd like to think that, you know, well, if you bend a little bit, it's going to, you know, it's going to come back to you. You know, it's going to pay for itself. And, yeah, you know, I mean, I'm happy with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think the production could have been a little better. You know, it's like, you know, it was good, but you don't go to a hamburger joint and get a pizza, you know.
Yeah,
you need to have people that play that type of music or record that type of music dealing with the stuff instead of just local, or, you know, they weren't local, but just instead of the names.
Right.
You know, you need trade talent or ability for the names.
Well, so when you toured, did you get any kind of help or support from the label? It was Caroline, right?
Right. I mean, very little. They were more of a distribution than they were like a, you know, a record label.
Yeah.
So it was something new for them. They didn't, you know, they were getting barraged, you know, from all different sides as far as who was contacting them, whether it was, you know, Sean or Mike, and, you know, doing prank calls and or whatever, and then, you know, having Elaine Ford, who was doing the booking, calling and saying she was our manager, and then having those guys call back and say, no, she don't speak for us. I mean, they were just getting mixed signals. They were getting tired of us. And, you know, it's just like, you can only mess with people so long, you know.
Nah.
And so, you know, they were trying to do what they could as far as where they, you know, as far as like radio, college radio and stuff, maybe some posters at the shows when we, you know, show up or whatever. But it was pretty scarce.
Mm-hmm. So I looked online and I saw somebody, this was just like on an Amazon page for your album or something, but somebody said, the blend of metal and punk that everyone was looking for without knowing it. I just wondered how you react to that description.
I have no problem with it. I question the people who write on Amazon.
Right.
A lot of them tend to be either fake or people that we know. You know.
Right.
Just,
sure.
But I think we were a good crossover, you know, mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's kind of what they were calling it at the time. You know, we were too punk for the metal kids and too metal for the punk kids, mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. So, the music wasn't exactly for everybody.
Right, but it seemed like that type of music then, a couple years later, got really big.
Right.
Or similar music, not exactly. So then, how did King Horse come to an end?
I want to say, well, you know, first it started with Sean. He quit the band, and for whatever reason, because, you know, whether it was a psychotic episode or whatever, he quit. Then we looked for other singers, and that didn't really pan out well. And I think we were laying in limbo. They decided to come back. I think Bakayu wasn't available. He didn't want to, we were trying to keep things going, play, whatever. Not necessarily shows, but practice, have fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was when he was doing his record store.
Right.
And I think he really couldn't be bothered with, you know, what we were trying to do at the time. So we wind up, I think Kevin and Sean finally got together and decided they wanted to try it again. Found another bass player and we played some shows, and then there was the big, you know, the big infamous show at the Grand where I I became intoxicated, overly intoxicated to play. And so, I mean, that was our big reunion show, actually. And then after, it wasn't long after that, we tried to redeem ourselves, and it just seems like the whole thing had started to fade away. And I mean, the crowds, the people, the venues, the, you know, I think it was time for a changing the guards, or, mm-hmm. you know, it's that cycle that happens with bands in the local music scene, I think.
Yeah.
So without, you know, just never, nothing was really said. It just kind of, everybody just quit coming in contact with one another.
Okay. All right. So that was like, what, the reunion was in 94 or something like that? I thought I saw that
somewhere. That's possible, yeah.
Okay. So then, did you go for a while without playing in a band?
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, because I'd gotten married and was mm-hmm. dealing with all that stupid stuff. And, you know, so got way out there in the country and away from all of it and didn't have any involvement with it and really wasn't even playing guitar at the time. Mm-hmm. And then I think, and I'm not sure who got a hold of me, but, you know, when we started, then Arch formed, and mm-hmm. it may have been, I'll say maybe in 2000, maybe.
Okay.
And so it was Jerry Cunningham, bass player that, you know, that played in the last days of King Horse.
Okay.
Paul Helvey and Alex Rose. So they wanted to, you know, do a band, and started playing with those guys, and it was totally something different to actually play with another guitar player for once. So it was maddening. It made me mad, you know, actually. And, you know, the one quote, you know, somebody said that I hadn't played. Let's see, how did they say it? But that they knew I haven't played guitar in a while, and it showed. So it was a whole getting back in the groove, actually playing again, trying to remember what I remembered, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, all in all, that was probably one of the just the writing and the songs. I mean, it's some of the stuff that I'm proudest of.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's the music or just the group of guys that wind up being, you know, at least toward the end, that was actually a fun band to play in. You know, you didn't have to babysit and all the things that go along with. Maybe you don't know that, but
I think I know a little about it.
You had a lot of stellar people in your bands, but
well, so when you came back, then how was the music scene different, or was it?
It was just like all the people that were, I mean, it was definitely different. All the people that were fans at one point in time had grown up. You know, they've moved on, they've gotten families or married, or, you know, they've become professional, or, you know, like some of the kids you see, you know, that there were fans now, that what they're doing is just amazing. And you go like, what happened? You know, I mean, here they are doing, you know, being the professionals, and now you're just still a musician, you know. I mean, that's it's kind of the way you look at it. But so it was like you had to develop a whole new fan base, but you still don't know where the fan base is coming from.
Mm-hmm. Was it younger, or did it tend to be more like your age?
They never seem like they're my age, but they always seem a little younger. But and I think, you know, there's the diehard people that'll be music fans all their life.
Right.
And then there's people that, you know, the new age, you know. So it just seemed like everybody under 30, you know, I mean, it seemed like that was, you know, the crowd, you know. What, you know, of course we weren't playing all age shows, right, and all that stuff, but and relying, so you had to rely on bar age people at least. So, but everybody at that point was, you know, between 21 and 30, I guess. And it was always, and I guess what's you know, what's happened with the whole music scene and whatever is, you know, the as people say, the stimulation or whatever, it can be satisfied at home now.
Right.
So whether it's YouTube or, you know, any of the streaming music stuff, I mean, everybody, they can hear their music and do whatever without being subjected to bars and the people that frequent bars.
Right. Well, so then how long did Arch go?
I want to say 2007, maybe.
Okay. And then when did the decline effect start up?
Geez. It seemed like it may have been a couple years after, 2009.
Okay.
Maybe. Right. I'm not sure on that.
Okay. So, anything to say about that band? I mean, I've taken so much of your time.
Oh, well, it's just jumping right back in the hot seat with my brother. You know, it was fun to play music again. It was fun as well as maddening. You know, and it's a, you know, there's always a fight right around the corner if you want it to be. You know, just him being able to appreciate. There's different, you know, it's a whole different group of people, a whole different set of circumstances. So, you know, brothers, he probably hadn't played in a while, but, you know, but the funny thing was the drummer was wind up being our little league coach's son.
Oh, right, okay.
Like from the West End. So, and they had knew each other from other bands. So, you know, me and my brother playing, you know, he decided he wanted to play music again, or at least jam. Then decided, well, why don't we take it a step further and get a drummer? And then somebody said, well, you know, what about Jay Brown? And so we, you know, tried him out, and it was just, and it was just a happy union, you know. So, you know, Jay had practice spot and, you know, the ability and the want to play. So, you know, it was pretty fun. And looked for Dave, and I think, or looked for a singer. And Dave was the first one that tried out. And so we thought that was going to be the ticket.
Okay.
You know, Dave from the Glass Pack.
Right. Okay. So in a way, like if I was a movie producer, so you've come full circle. But, you know, I mean, just sort of how do you reflect on playing music now? What? I mean, you know, close to 40 years. Am I doing my math right? I think I am. 79 to would be 2019. Yeah, that'd be 40 years. I mean, you know, what do you think about it? I mean, how do you reflect on this long period of playing music in Louisville? What's the thing that you want people to know?
I don't know. I mean, that's pretty deep, you know.
Well, let me just ask you this. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you think is important? there any other facets of the scene or stuff you've done?
No, I don't know. I mean, I just, you know, it's strange, you know, to have, I mean, there's people that have hung on, you know, for the whole duration of the movie, and they still make an appearance once in a while. You know, I mean, always, I don't know, you play to play, and you want people to like what you're doing, but then again, you take the hard-ass attitude, well, I don't care if you don't like it, because I'm playing for myself, but in reality, you're playing, you know, you want people to like it. So you just hope people find something, you know, something in my body of music that they can enjoy. You know, they don't necessarily have to like everything. Mm-hmm. As chances are, I probably don't. If I have to look back, there's probably bits and pieces that I don't like that I've accomplished.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This has been great. I really appreciate your taking the time, and I think you gave me a lot of good stuff for future scholars of the Louisville music scene.
So, that's good.
Okay, well, I'm going to press.